Because so many of us are so busy just trying to work and take care of our kids, sleep, exercise, all these basic needs that we're trying to get met. It does not leave a lot of room for just hanging out. But that's something that I think we need. I think we're really rich in America in financial ways, but impoverished in terms of community.
Diversity of ideas is harder than it looks. Welcome to Innovation for All, conversations on the social impact of innovation with your host, Shayna Ahlquist.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Shayna Ahlquist here with a very special bonus episode of Innovation for All. So although we are now well into 2019, I wanted to take an opportunity to reflect on all the conversations we've had so far. So rather than a typical episode where I'm going to have a long interview with a single guest, this episode is a little bit different. Specifically, I've reached out to a few of my favorite guests from the first season and asked them to answer two key questions. First, what's something they've changed their mind about in 2018? So as you know, I like to ask every guest this question, what's something they've changed their mind about? But I wanted to take a little bit a longer perspective here. So thinking about 2018, like what's something they came into the year thinking that they may have revised their opinion about over the course of the year? And similarly, I've asked every guest to look ahead to 2019. What's something that they think should become part of the conversation that everybody else is currently overlooking? We have a lot of great guests in this episode. So we have included in the show notes the names and prior episode information for every guest. So if there's someone you especially like and you haven't heard their full episode, you'll have the opportunity to do that by visiting innovationforallcast.com, where we list all of our show notes. And last but not least, at the end of the episode, I myself answer these two questions as well. And a final warning, I did ask my guests to record this sort of on the fly, so please excuse any varying audio quality from guest to guest. I assure you that the content that they are sharing is well worth any audio snafus. And lastly, what do you think of this special episode? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Would you like to see it the same, but with a little twist? I'd love your feedback. You can shoot me an email at info@innovationforallcast.com. That's info@innovationforallcast.com. And with that, enjoy some of my favorite guests.
Hello, my name is Jordan Axt. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at Duke University, as well as director of data and methodology for Project Implicit, which is a nonprofit organization interested in studying the consequences of implicit bias. One thing I changed my mind about in 2018 is that there may be more effective or efficient ways to reduce discrimination than traditional diversity or bias trainings. In fact, in a lot of areas, we might be able to reduce the magnitude of discrimination if we just make people better evaluators or decision makers in general, not specifically about social biases. One thing I think has been missing from the conversation about discrimination or implicit bias that I'd like to see gain more attention in 2019 is the fact that for a lot of these diversity trainings or implicit bias trainings, we really lack good data, good field data on how they're working, whether they're working, or if they're working at all. And so it's not as if we have evidence that these things aren't working. We just don't really have evidence either way. And so I'd love to see both researchers and people within organizations take this challenge more seriously and pay more attention to it.
My name is Amanda Lotz. I'm a professor of media studies at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. Something that I've changed my mind about in the course of 2018 was the importance of content or catalog to services such as Netflix or competition generally in the over the internet distributed television and film environment. I think we've focused on who has what movies or what television shows, and there's been a lot of attention on development and even the awards, you know, things like Handmaid's Tale winning the Emmy this past year. But I think that when we focus on content, we overlook the issue of experience. And historically, experience hasn't really been a big deal in television because the experience was sort of assumed to be the same. But as we look forward into 2019, when a lot of big name companies are announcing and launching new services, Disney and Warner Media in particular, And everybody seems to be really focused on the content and the intellectual property, and that is really the key determining factor about what's coming in terms of competition. What I think that conversation misses, though, is the fact that it's a lot harder to build an internet-distributed video platform that works well every time. Part of that is that I've just been experimenting with some others lately and found just how awful they are in comparison with that Netflix experience. But I also think that this is a competency that hasn't traditionally been central in the entertainment industry. And I think it's really easy to discount the idea that, you know, a big name company can simply launch something that's going to work, that's going to, every time you ask for a video, serve it right up without a gap, make sure that it runs to completion. All of those things on the technical side, and just the idea that maybe people are turning to services such as Netflix and Hulu because the experience is better, because they can sit down and decide what to watch and watch exactly that in that moment, that they can pick up from whatever show that they were in the middle of watching instead of, you know, being fed a schedule. And I think that that issue of experience too is more important than we let on, and that maybe people are actually watching a good bit of, let's say, content that they'd rate a B+ maybe on Netflix, and doing that instead of watching content that might be an A- on a linear service, simply because that linear service experience is so poor. So the thing that I am thinking about anew as we end 2018 and go into 2019 is the way to make sure that experience is part of the conversation when we're talking about internet distributed television and film. Something that's been missing from the conversation in the last year in particular has been the availability of internet, of the role of internet service providers, whether they be data providers for phone service or home internet service, and just the way in which those services have gotten to a point where they have exceptional power over our experience with the internet, and that they're in a position where there's very little competition, and that you know, really puts them in the driver's seat going forward to control how anything that is internet-based can be used. And so part of this is certainly coming off of all of the conversation in 2017 about net neutrality, kind of a quiet year last year as we awaited some sort of action on the legal front. Hopefully that will pick back up. But even, you know, and net neutrality is a really big part of that. But even aside from net neutrality, the degree to which the experience of internet access is so varied across the country, and that there just doesn't seem to be a whole lot of attention to the need for rural communities to have better options. And those are better options that aren't going to come without some sort of activity from the government or encouragement to industry, because the margins simply aren't there. And so the fact that we really have a country that is increasingly experiencing this next stage of economies, of convenience, of education, all in a very different way, is something that needs a lot more attention.
I'm Jutta Dobranus. I established and direct the Inclusive Design Research Center at OCAD University in Toronto. The IDRC, which turned 25 years this year, is the nexus of a fairly amazing, growing global community that proactively works to ensure that our digitally transformed and globally connected society is designed to be inclusive. What have I changed my mind about in 2018? I seem to have lost faith that the basic structures of democracy will always lead to social good. The part of democracy that I find problematic in today's reality is the precept of majority rules. This was a liberating precept when battling elitist autocratic structures of the past. However, in today's local reality, when the attention and self-interest of the many moves increasingly away from the life or death concerns of the few, majority rules becomes an excuse to abandon the most vulnerable. If there are more voters in my riding that are concerned about fixing the potholes in front of their driveways than there are voters worried about essential services to keep their child alive, the candidate promising to fix potholes will win, and the potholes will be the priority. In this polarized climate where democracy is under threat, this is a risky yet necessary critique. We need to protect and sustain democracy, but we need to find a way to advance the structures of democracy to recognize and weigh the quality and not just the quantity of our collective decisions. Somehow, We need to protect human rights and social justice from the erosive manipulation of one person, one vote. What's something that's been missing from the conversation that you'd like to see gain more interest in 2019? With respect to data, we've been obsessed with an undefined notion of privacy. This topic has sucked up all the airtime. Privacy, I find, is the luxury of the already secure. The people most vulnerable to data abuse and misuse are also the people least protected by privacy protections. They are the ones most easily re-identified when we follow the privacy by design requirement to de-identify data at source. If you are the only Black person in a white neighborhood, you can be easily re-identified. If you're the only person in your neighborhood buying colostomy bags, you can be re-identified. Also, if you're living at the margins, you often have no choice but to barter your privacy for survival. What needs to get more attention is transparency of data use and ethical data use, because privacy will be breached. As part of this conversation, we need to discuss how we use data to guide our decisions. Evidence-based decision-making that only takes into account the largest number will lead to greater and greater disparity between the majority and the many increasingly desperate minorities. This is a conversation I think that is critical to have in the upcoming 2019 when so many decisions are being made.
Henry Ford once said, "If I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses." Sounds like Ford hired a bad user researcher. PhD Insights is different. They help understand the attitudes and motivations that underlie what customers claim. And this is good for business. So if your company isn't adding attitudinal feedback to their data pipeline, they're missing half the story. Learn how PhD Insights can help your company with pricing, product strategy, and positioning by visiting phdinsights.com. That's phd-insights.com.
Hello, I'm Oshonde Oshaba. I'm a researcher at the RAND Corporation. I work in the field of artificial intelligence, specifically developing models to answer policy questions or thinking through the implications of AI for policy. Okay, something I've changed my mind about in the last year, 2018. I would say I'm more convinced about the ability of advances in technology to reduce the sharpness of the trade-off between privacy preservation and data utility. Now, the background behind this line of thinking is last year and still going on this year, there's a lot of angst and hand-wringing over the ascendancy of China in the space of artificial intelligence. And part of the argument, part of the concern in that line of thinking is that, well, the United States has more privacy restrictions. EU has a lot more privacy restrictions on data you can collect on subjects. China has different constraints on privacy and data privacy, sometimes arguably less. There's a little bit of nuance in that discussion there. The upside, the summary of that line of thinking is that, well, because there is less privacy in China, they have more data they can use. They have access to more data they can use to train artificial intelligence models. And the corollary to that is that as long as privacy is a thing, as long as privacy is important, there is no way we can maintain, or any other country can maintain, a cutting edge, a frontier ability in artificial intelligence. Exposure to work on differentially private machine learning, that would be one example of a level shifting innovation, i.e. it allows us to derive utility from data sets at a higher level while still retaining a higher level of privacy. But I think the more interesting one I was recently exposed to was the idea of federated machine learning. This is the idea that you can maintain a central model, a central large-scale model that's being updated not by access to sensitive private user data, but by access to gradients generated locally by users on their own devices, then transmitted to some central model. So it's learning via the gradients, but not necessarily learning via access to the raw data. So this is a way of improving learning while still preserving the privacy of the users generating the data on which learning is supposed to be proceeding. So it seems like it's possible that technology can help us achieve some level of privacy while still keeping us on that march forward in terms of artificial intelligence. Okay, then I think we're missing from the conversation, and I'd like to see gain more interest in the next year. In summary, we should take the evolutionary paradigm more seriously as we think through technology, regulation, and culture. Now, this idea, it started off last year with an exposure to some research and some commercial work done by researchers up north in Silicon Valley and in Texas, in which they were putting evolution to work to solve real-world problems. This is a field of artificial intelligence almost as old as the entire field of AI itself, this area of evolutionary computing. And the idea is just to create artificial agents operating within an environment in which fitness is defined in terms of solving the problem the designers care about. So if you can imagine designing a fitness function in terms of market behavior, market success, or in terms of click-through, or in terms of recognition accuracy. It works really well, and it probably the area of the use of evolutionary computational algorithms will probably be more important in the next few years as an alternative learning principle to standard gradient descent, some version of gradient descent. But that's not what I'm focusing on. What I'd like to focus on, or at least draw attention to, is the fact that that metaphor, that paradigm of evolution of natural selection applies not just in biological systems, not just in simulated algorithmic systems, but also when we think about regulation. In a sense, regulations are adapting to solve a problem in the environment. We would like to assume or imagine that they are adapting over a fitness function that's aligned to what we care about, i.e. improving the human condition or improving the welfare of a particular state. We should probably examine that assumption a bit more. But if we think in terms of the evolutionary program, when thinking about regulation, it helps us see a bit better how our systems are aligned, how our regulatory systems are aligned. Besides the regulatory system, you can also think of the evolutionary paradigm applied to technology. Technology involves innovations over time, innovations that better solve a problem that's being experienced in society will tend to persist. It's a bit fuzzy because sometimes the innovations don't necessarily solve a problem, they just are mimetic or resonant. And so you have this evolution of technology over time. The same thing can be said of the evolution of culture. Okay, here there's some natural selection process and some cultural fads rise and fall based on how well they fit in the environment. And in this case, again, fitness may not be strictly about how good the mutation is, but more about cultural resonance. Anyway, I think that perspective is fruitful and should probably gain more attention in the next year.
I'm Eliza Kooner. I'm a mother of three children, and I'm a data scientist. Currently, I'm not working as a data scientist, but I'm just home taking care of my three kids, the youngest of whom is 9 months. It's getting to be almost her first birthday, and it reminds me of the decision I made when she was young to stay with her and quit my job at Facebook, even though I was really happy there. I had wanted to work part-time, but they didn't have an option for that. I ended up writing about it and starting a bit of a discussion movement around how companies that have the resources ought to be providing more flexible options for parents. Something I changed my mind about in 2018. I had started to feel kind of jaded when I wanted, like many people, to change the world. I felt like I didn't know how to make a difference. Things were going downhill and I felt very powerless as an individual. And my experience writing about Facebook and getting so much response and seeing discussion really started made me see that actually one person can make a big difference just by speaking up. And of course, I couldn't have done it alone. It was the fact that so many people were thinking that that made it possible. But it really showed me how important it is to say what's on your mind and what you're feeling and speak to your own experience and how things ought to be, because you're not the only one thinking it. But the louder you can make your voice, the wider that message spreads, the more difference you can make. So it really changed my perspective on how I could be in the world and how much difference you can make. Also, I think I've always been very outspoken, but I've gotten messages throughout my life that I need to kind of tone myself down and not be so angry. Don't object so much and, you know, respect the boundaries. And I was trying to do that for a long time. But again, I found with this that actually being loud and saying what I thought was much more powerful. And I'm not going to feel guilty or apologize for being an outspoken, strong woman anymore. The other question was, what's something that should be brought into the discussion? That's my daughter, Adeline, making noise while I talk. Hi. What's something that I like people to talk more about, I think it was? You know, I've talked a lot about the need for more work-life balance and the need for parents to be allowed to spend time with their kids and have a job if they want to make that choice. One thing that hasn't really been talked about much yet is not just the benefit for the individual and having more flexible work or shorter hours, maybe cutting out the commute, is the benefit to the community. You know, in Spain, they have plazas. And when I was visiting last year, I saw people would just come there, families, the old people, young people, would all be together spending time, relaxing and playing, making music. And I wanted to have that in my own community. But I realized that even if we were to create the space for it, the trouble is where to find the people to fill it. Because so many of us are so busy just trying to work and take care of our kids, sleep, exercise, all these basic needs that we're trying to get met. It does not leave a lot of room for just hanging out. But that's something that I think we need. I think we're really rich in America in financial ways, but impoverished in terms of community. Having shorter work hours for those who want it, or even for everyone, would leave more space for people to just be out and engaged with their neighborhood, which would help our community grow and nurture us in ways that I don't think everyone has really taken time to think about. That is, it's going to make us happy in a way that money can't. Obviously, money is really important, but community is really important too. People are happier when they have connections. So the need for community for each town, each neighborhood, to have a place to gather and have space in their minds and in their time together is something that's not talked about enough. And I think it's time to acknowledge that this is something we're missing.
Hi, I'm Sally Hubbard. I am an expert on antitrust law and tech platforms. I also host the Women Killing It podcast. Something that I changed my mind about in 2018 was the divide that we have in our country, the political polarization. Before 2018, I didn't really think it was possible to bridge the divide. Now, toward the end of the year, I've come around and I think that there is more that unites us than divides us. And I think if we start speaking to one another and getting together on issues that are common among us all, we can actually move forward in reuniting this country. And actually, one issue, my favorite issue, anti-monopoly policy, is something that is felt no matter where you are on the political spectrum and no matter what your beliefs are. This is actually one of the very few topics that the left and the right can agree on. Something that's missing from the conversation is an understanding for regular people of how monopolies affect their everyday life. from having to pay higher taxes to having less choice to not having control over what information they see. And I want to try to make these messages much more understandable and get people thinking about the systemic inequality that we have because of the concentrated economic power and hence concentrated political power. So that's my goal in 2019, to make these anti-monopoly issues something that people can understand and mobilize around.
I'm Shayna Ahlquist. I have a PhD in social psychology and left academia to pursue interests in product development and entrepreneurship. I currently host the Innovation for All podcast. What's something you changed your mind about in 2018? When I went into 2018, I wholeheartedly believed that tech was good, that people who create tech are good, and that basically anything tech does wrong is really the fault of people who have it. I don't totally disagree with parts of that, but I think my opinion has become much more nuanced. In particular, what I changed my mind about in 2018 is that basically that we didn't need to regulate big tech companies. You know, I think the people who head large organizations like the leaders of Google, the leaders of Facebook, in many ways, they're doing really, really a lot right. You know, Google's motto up until just a couple years ago was don't be evil, which is kind of a ridiculous and absurd motto. And you do still see that being embodied by the culture of their employees. They really think like, would this be a googly thing to do to take certain actions? All that being said, I think the fact that these companies are run by people who do mean to do the best they can in many ways has protected them from regulation for a long time. So these companies have now become so powerful and have so much impact on so many different people's lives. I no longer think that it is fair to give the responsibility to just them. So I would like to see in the next few years a more thoughtful, nuanced conversation about how we should protect ourselves from the power that these companies have accumulated. What's something that's been missing from the conversation that you'd like to see gain more interest in 2019? So that's the whole point of this podcast, which is great. But one thing in particular that I'm excited about right now is the possibility of tech workers forming unions and getting more collective bargaining. So this might sound absurd, but essentially, tech workers really aren't unionized, right? Like all the coders at like a Google or a Facebook, they're kind of just one guy, one girl here, clocking in, clocking out. And so in some ways, although we expect them to have a lot of power, they kind of don't. But I think over the course of the next year or two, we're going to see these communities realize that they do have tremendous power, especially if they band together. So if the Google coders, for instance, say, we're not going to build a Muslim database or else, like we're just not going to do it. You know, Google, not that they've asked for that, I think, would be pretty much helpless, right? So I think one thing we're going to see in 2019 and the coming years would be more collective bargaining and more unionization of tech workers broadly.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If so, I invite you to subscribe to Innovation for All on iTunes or your favorite podcasting platform. Thank you to our producer, Nia Taylor, our audio engineer, Dave Visaya, and Glorianne Oke, who compiles our show notes. You can view show notes from this and every episode at innovationforallcast.com.